From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Milwaukee's Mount Mary University hopes a new housing project will help their student parents graduate. Then costume designer and drag performer Patrick Holt remembers what first drew him to the art form.
It was like opening the door in The Wizard of Oz, and everything was suddenly in Technicolor. I saw these people who had total joy, no excuses, and were just living this heightened reality that to me seemed completely magical. Who wouldn't that appeal to?
Plus, film contributor Dave Lurson joins us to talk about the World War I epic directed by Sam Mendes, 1917.
He impressed me with the cinematography and the assembly of the shots to suggest the idea that there was a camera following everyone around through the course of a two-hour adventure across no man's land.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee's Mount Mary University is planning a unique housing project that will serve students who are single mothers alongside aging nuns and other senior citizens. The intergenerational living complex combines two goals: bring the school sisters of Notre Dame back to the university they helped found, and support student parents who often struggle to graduate from college. The $45 million project will break ground this summer, and it's expected to open on the private women's college campus before the end of 2021. WUWM's education reporter Emily Files spoke with Mount Mary President Christine Farr. She explained that the idea of building an on-campus residence for the School Sisters of Notre Dame has been in the works for a couple of years. Adding student mothers to the mix came later.
The concept of the School Sisters of Notre Dame moving to the Mount Mary campus has been something that numerous people over the years have talked about. I began to talk to Sister Deb Ciano, who's the provincial, that's the leader of the School Sisters of Notre Dame for the Central Pacific Province. And she was talking about the fact that the sisters were obviously decreasing in number and increasing in age, and we're probably going to have to find some other solutions. And so we hatched this plan that the school sisters would potentially move back to the Mount Mary campus and that we would build housing for them that ultimately could be converted into student housing as their numbers declined.
I want to get to how the student single mothers got included in this plan. But could we go back to the relationship between the School Sisters of Notre Dame and Mount Mary? Just a brief history of that. You're saying they're coming back to campus.
Sure. So the School Sisters of Notre Dame started Mount Mary University well over 100 years ago. And it was originally located in Prairie du Chien. And in 1929, the first building, Notre Dame Hall, was built on the current site. At that time, the school sisters lived on campus in one of the buildings. And so the school began in that way. And then as the number of students increased and the buildings on campus began to increase, eventually they bought property over in Elm Grove and they built a convent over there. At that time, when the school started, the faculty were largely School Sisters of Notre Dame, as were the staff. So the school was almost completely run by them.
So tell me about how the idea of including housing for students who happen to be parents and single mothers became part of this plan.
So this was my idea, and it came from a fact that previous to being here in Milwaukee, I was a vice president for academic affairs at College of St. Mary in Omaha, Nebraska. And that institution, more by accident than anything, started a program for single mothers and their children. And so I was there during the time that that program was going very well. And I saw the difference that it made. What I know about single mothers and their children is that that's probably the demographic that has the most difficult time getting an education. They face a lot of obstacles including the cost of an education, transportation, childcare, and simply having the resources that they need to be able to get all of those needs met. And so this seemed like the perfect way to bring the sisters together with a demographic of students in the Milwaukee area that could benefit tremendously from having the kind of support and resources that a program like this would offer.
What is the current picture at Mount Mary when it comes to student parents? Is this a demographic that is all that already has a strong presence at Mount Mary, or is the hope that this new housing opportunity would draw more student parents to the school?
So we do certainly have a demographic of students. We somewhere between 10 and 20% of our students right now are single parents. I don't actually know the number that are parents.
Undergrad and grad students?
Yes. Okay. We do have students right now that could clearly benefit from this. I know a couple students who actually live on campus and their children live with their parents off campus or elsewhere. And that's a really difficult situation for those students. But in addition, what we know is that there are large numbers of single women going back to school across the nation. And those students find it very difficult. They have a dropout rate that is twice as high as women with no children. And so what we want to do is create an environment that might make Mount Mary attractive to young women who have children who would like to be in an environment where they have the kind of support that can make graduating much easier.
Childcare is a huge issue for single parents and non-single parents. So is that going to be something that's available in this intergenerational housing community?
Absolutely, it is. So we're going to have a pretty good size early childhood education center. So it will be more than just daycare. It will actually be an educational environment. And we are also going to be working with our education department so that our own students can benefit from this environment, so that we can have student learning. And so certainly the single mothers will have their child care there. But in addition, we will open this up to faculty and staff and to people from the outside as well.
Mm-hmm. And what does Mount Mary currently offer for student parents? Is there child care on campus or other supports currently offered?
There is not. And so there was at one time in the past. That hasn't existed for a number of years. And so ever since I arrived, many people on campus have asked me to reconsider opening that.
I found this interesting data that more than one in five college students are parents. It is a big demographic out there that's going to have some unique needs. And for colleges today, a lot of colleges are at this point where they're trying to innovate because of declining enrollment and the competitive environment. So is this an effort by Mount Mary to kind of carve out a niche that might make the school more competitive when seeking out students, especially non-traditional students?
Absolutely. I think we all know that right now the number of high school students graduating is declining in the Midwest, and Wisconsin is no exception to that. And so all of us are trying to think about how can we continue to serve that population, but also reinvent ourselves to serve different demographics. So I would say this venture offers not only a wonderful opportunity for single mothers to get an education, but also a way for us to reimagine how we might do intergenerational education, how we might do lifelong learning opportunities for seniors who live in this space. So I see it as a win-win all the way around.
Christine Farr is the president of Mount Mary University, a private women's college in Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's education reporter Emily Files about a new intergenerational housing project soon to be built on campus. It'll serve student parents along with nuns and seniors from the community. Coming up next, we'll talk with a costume designer for The Legend of Georgia McBride, opening tonight at the Milwaukee Rep. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We'll be right back. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Legend of Georgia McBride opens tonight at the Milwaukee Rep. It's the story of an Elvis impersonator who has to change his act when his club hires drag performers to bring in more customers. The show is funny and heartfelt and full of feathers and sequins. And the person in charge of those feathers and sequins and all the rest of the costuming for the show is Patrick Holt. Holt is a professional costume designer and a professor of design at the University of Arizona. He's also a drag performer himself with the stage name of Tempest Du Jour. I met Holt at the Rep to find out more about the Legend of Georgia McBride and about drag itself. Patrick, it is such a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting.
Well, I want to talk about drag.
Let's do it.
I want to talk about it as a phenomenon and what it means. And so starting with yourself, how did you get interested in it? What was it about it that drew you to the art form?
Well, there's a multifaceted answer here. I think a lot of it was probably the fact that I was raised in a very conservative religious home. And the first time I saw drag, it was like opening the door in The Wizard of Oz at Dorothy, and everything was suddenly in Technicolor. And I saw these people who had total joy, no excuses, and were just living this heightened reality that to me seemed completely magical. Who wouldn't that appeal to is the question, right? To me, it was fascinating. You know, it was a little closeted gay Mormon kid who saw another life in another world that I didn't know existed. And to me, it was just, it was magic.
We as humans just have a fascination with transgression in terms of gender, whether it's men to women, women to men, whatever it might happen to be. I mean, Shakespeare plays with it all the time. And I find it fascinating that we as a species seem to need this, that this is something we require. And I never thought of drag that way until I was older. And I thought, wait, you know, I think this is something we all require in some form.
It's interesting. You know, the evolution of men performing as women is fascinating to me. I've studied, you know, when I'm not designing great theatrical productions like this one, I'm a professor at the University of Arizona. And I've spent a lot of time studying this, you know, from the beginnings of ancient theater where women weren't allowed, and so men played all the roles, into Shakespeare where there were actors like Nathan Field who made a career. He originated the part of Desdemona and Juliet, and then on through history. And people, I don't think Americans especially understand the history of men playing women's roles and how huge that was. There were, you know, at the turn of the century and into the 1912s and 20s, there were Broadway stars who did complete drag shows that are sort of lost to history. They were so popular. One, Julian L. Tinge was so popular, he had a women's magazine where he gave advice to women, and he was a big star. And somewhere along the way, that became dirty and immoral. I have lots of theories about why is that so, but show me, you know, the most hetero, you know, frat bro that hasn't dressed in drag for Halloween or something. So there is this need to explore that somehow, or to feel the silliness of it, or to sort of revel in something completely different. I'm not sure. I'm not a psychologist, but for me, it's joy. I call it the mask of drag. When I put on drag, it's a mask to me. I get to be this person that I don't have to be in normal life. I can walk into any club in drag and people want their picture with me and I'm friends with everybody. I walk in as Patrick, myself, and no one takes a second look. It's a magical thing to me. And that mask has, I think, magical powers.
It's interesting to me that, you know, as men dressing as women, is taking that transgression, you know, or finding the feminine in themselves, whatever that happens to be. I find it interesting as a woman from my perspective, because it's like, you know, to me, male equals power in our society. So why would you want to give that up?
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. And I've thought about that actually quite a bit. And I don't really have an answer to that, except that I think there was a certain relief that I know many of us experience in drag. And maybe there's a feminine side of us that we need to let out or explore. But I also know drag queens who you would never in a million years guess were even, you know, nothing but the butchest of the straight guy in the world when they're out of drag. You know, whatever that need is, and maybe it's just attention. Maybe it's as simple as that, just the attention you get from being in drag. But maybe it is deeper for some people. They need to explore that feminine side and what that means. I don't like when people equate it to sexuality and to sexual identity, because it has, to me, nothing to do with that. It's an art form, an expression. It's a character I play. It's not who I am. I don't want to be a woman. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be a woman. You know, transgender people and cross-dressing people are not drag queens. And drag queens don't consider themselves that either. There's a very defined line between those worlds. What we do is entertainment in drag. It's not an identifier to us beyond that.
And so when you first started, did you have your character in mind from the beginning, or is that something that developed over time as you performed?
I think my character as Tempest Du Jour has I had a pretty clear idea.
Which is a great name. Well, I love drag names.
Thank you. I had a pretty clear idea what I wanted to do and be. I felt very limited in the beginning too, because I'm as a man flat-footed, I'm 6'6". When I started drag, I was 160 pounds heavier, so I was this big, giant man. And I thought, I have to be silly, because when I walk in heels and hair, I'm hitting 8 feet. You know, I'm a giant queen.
Kind of divine.
Yeah, and you know, I should be so lucky. Yeah. But yeah, to me, the camp and the kitsch and the comedy of drag is what's most appealing to me. I've seen, you know, there's so many genres of drag that are acceptable now. Every genre is acceptable. There's room for everyone at the drag table. Even, you know, there's a big trend of bio queens now who are you know, women who do drag, and you know, every sort of variation you can think of exists in drag, which is something that is so appealing to me and makes it so beautiful. I'm 52 years old, so I grew up in a generation of Flip Wilson and Klinger on MASH and Tootsie in high school, and we didn't have drag images on television or in film necessarily. And those
that were powerful.
That were powerful, or even right. That even kind of existed other than a joke.
Right.
And but there was something about it that I saw that was very liberating to these men who put on dresses and were able to entertain and get away with stuff that you couldn't normally get away with. And I think that, to me, was a big appeal. And when I'm in drag and a mic in my hand, it does sort of excuse you from a lot of things. It's like being a stand-up comic in many ways, that people, you can get away with saying things that you wouldn't otherwise, being a social mirror.
I think of it almost like the fool in Shakespeare, being able to speak truth to power in any way, shape, or form and getting away with
it. That's exactly, you've nailed it. That's exactly what it is.
And it's also fabulous in that it's so over the top in so many ways, and that you get to experience that. I mean, I remember when I first learned what drag was, I was probably a teenager, and I'm a little older than you are, and I remember thinking, but wait, you know, I want to do that too. Because at that time it was, you know, men do drag,
right.
You know, women don't do that. But like you say, now it's kind of, you can exaggerate and find a character and wear the fabulous costumes or the over the top, whatever it is you want to do, whoever it is that you are in that mask. And I think that's a really wonderful thing.
It's amazing. I think we have RuPaul to thank for, you know, it's so cliche to say now that RuPaul mainstream drag, but really RuPaul mainstream drag with the popularity of RuPaul's Drag Race. And it just opened the eyes of so many people around the world. It plays everywhere now. And there's, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race, of course, in America and in the UK now. There's an Australian one season starting next year. There's the Thailand series. So in Canada, it's expanding, and the popularity of drag has been incredible. And thank God for it. I mean, it's such an amazing sort of an expression of creativity and for so many people, and to see young kids especially not have to hide and have that sort of vehicle for expression is of course something I'm jealous of because we didn't have that. But I embrace it, and I think it's wonderful.
So in the role, you're not actually doing a drag role here at The Rep. You are actually designing costumes for other people to do drag roles. And so when you move into that part of your expertise, how are you approaching that and thinking about those characters that are not your character?
Well, you know, every time I design costumes for a show, I try to make it as personal as I can by identifying a character with somebody I know or somebody I'm familiar with, so I can get into the deep details of who they are and why they would wear what they wear and those sorts of things. This show is easy because I know so many different drag queens and kinds and genres of drag queens. And so it's like I know these girls already. I know who they are. I know their motivation. I know where they came from. And it's such a joy. I've said before, and I'll say again, I would make a career of just designing this show if I could, because it's so much fun. And everyone who plays the role, this is the third time I've designed this show, everyone who plays the drag roles comes in with their own level of exposure and experience to drag and their own history. And it's so fun to sort of mold that character with them and decide what's most appropriate.
Do you find that some of the actors coming in doing this in the times that you've designed this have discovered things about themselves as they have negotiated whoever this character is and what they might wear, that they find things out about themselves personally that you might not necessarily in, I don't know, Arthur Miller?
Well, yeah, for sure. For sure. I think, you know, we have the luxury, in a sense, in this production of the two leads who are coming and playing drag characters. Well, all three of them who play drag characters have experience in drag. That can be a bonus or not so much, because they have ideas coming in of what they think they should be or what they want to be based on their own drag characters. But I love exploring that with them. I'll sit in a fitting as we're trying stuff on, and I'm sort of half observer and half psychologist in the fitting room of watching how they react, putting things on, and when they feel comfortable enough to make suggestions or not. And it's a give and take. Many times we hit it right on the head and they love what they wear. And you see them put something on and you see something click in them as well. Like, oh, I get it. This is where we are and this is where we're going. And that's the magic to me of costume design. That's why I love that so much. It's creating people and characters. And I love to see them find that joy.
You've done this three times. How has it fed back into your own drag performances? Or has it?
You know, I say this is the perfect play for someone who has much experience with drag or zero experience with drag. It runs the gamut of emotions of a drag in this play. There's so many joyful, like happy, silly moments. But there's also some incredibly deep and powerful and gut-wrenching moments as well. I always say you'll laugh and you'll cry. There was that old line, you'll laugh, you'll cry, it's better than Cats, which we can say in all sincerity now, relating to the movie.
Yes.
But there's these moments where every character in the play has this moment of truth and these moments of epiphany where they discover something about themselves, about drag, about the other people around them. And it's so beautifully stated. Matthew Lopez, who wrote the play, does a genius job of expressing where we've come from and why it's necessary.
I am so looking forward to seeing this. Will we ever have a chance up here to see you perform?
Well, last year I was here performing what we call sort of a regular club gig at a local club. I was hoping to try to perform while I was here this time. The schedule probably won't allow it, but I'll be back. Never count me out.
Good. And I'd love to come and see you perform.
I would love for you to come see it. Yeah.
But anyway, Patrick, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Patrick Holt is the costume designer for The Legend of Georgia McBride, opening at the Milwaukee Rep tonight. There's more information and some photos from the show at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break and then speak with Madison author Dick Wagner about Wisconsin's early gay history. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. All places around the globe have a gay history, but it's still a largely untold one, particularly in Wisconsin. The national narrative of gay history often involves events that took place on the coasts, the most recognizable being Stonewall. However, according to scholar and activist Dick Wagner, there was a pre-Stonewall liberation for gays and lesbians in Wisconsin. His new book, We've Been Here All Along, examines Wisconsin's early gay history from 1895 to 1969. Wagner joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone last fall and began by explaining why the early gay history of this state was worth his in-depth examination.
What's noteworthy to me is that before Stonewall, you had gays and lesbians in Wisconsin figuring out their identities. They were forming networks of support, which basically is the same liberation that starts to occur greatly after Stonewall. And so you have a pre-Stonewall liberation occurring that is hardly known by folks either in the state or even beyond the state's boundaries.
Right. People don't often think about gay history, especially in the Midwest, much less what occurred on the various coasts in the United States.
Right, right. So, you know, the title We've Been Here All Along is a little stab at, you know, like gay history began before Stonewall, and gay history was not all on the East Coast with Stonewall riots in New York, nor all on the West Coast with the early homophile organizations that were founded out there.
And how did Wisconsin's climate fare compared to other states across the U.S.? I mean, in general, places were very homophobic, especially in early history and especially post-World War II. But what was Wisconsin like?
Well, Wisconsin had the whole apparatus of homophobia. It had legal prohibitions. It had police enforcements. It had the courts opining about how horrible the crime of sodomy was. And then after World War II, it had the whole medical apparatus of sickness that was applied. So Wisconsin had the whole basis of homophobia, which makes the remarkable brave stories of men and women who sorted out their lives positively even more remarkable.
Right. And with researching this book extensively, you have great primary documents, photos. What challenges did you face when collecting your research, and what sources did you end up going to back and back again?
I came across surprising resources, and learning how to interpret them, knowing the general writing about gay and lesbian history nationwide, gave me sort of frameworks to go look. The book by Alan Burby about coming out under fire had just one footnote about a Truax study in it. That was done by a professor at the University of Wisconsin Medical School and a psychiatrist who was at the Truax Army Air Force Base. And so I actually dug out the study, and the study, while it was about endocrine theories of homosexuality, which was not proved by the study, nevertheless took some life histories of the gay men who were in the study. And one of the just sort of astounding things was that they all rejected the sickness description that had been applied for the medical screening of homosexuals out from World War II. And then there was this throwaway line that the researchers listed that four of them were members of a gay organization, and this was in 1945 here in Madison, Wisconsin. So that just sort of blew my mind that when you start tracking from sources that, you know, there's this sort of total resistance to the self-imposed homophobia that they're supposed to internalize.
And I imagine you needed to pay special attention to language, whether it was finding primary documents
right.
that were within gay groups in Madison and beyond. And the nature of your research with researching people during a period where evidence could be used against them. So finding those subtleties. So what did you find that were key instances or words to look out for, or what did you learn to, like, filter through in your mind?
Well, some of the visible folks were Bob Neal and Edgar Hellam in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. In the 1930s, the two of them bought these little Cornish cottages and started to fix them up and run an antique shop and then eventually sort of a Cornish meal operation out of these old homes. And there were lots of descriptions about them, and they talked about the partners. They didn't use a qualifier like business partners, but they also talked about artistic and about young men, even though they were middle-aged in terms of the lifespan of the period. So clearly these code words were being used to describe them. And you also get some other words that are less coded, like fairy or pixies or other things like that, that get applied to men in the pre-World War II period. So if you know what to look for, you can find the stuff.
With the structure of homophobia, the press certainly played a role in that. And I found it fascinating, you know, the power of language, whether that be in suppressing representation of people or recognition, even though most of the time it was negative, from where you start the book with Oscar Wilde's trial being right. covered in Wisconsin to beyond. With you as a researcher and a writer, how did you reflect upon use of language throughout all of the research you were doing?
To me, it was interesting to see how people changed sort of positions. In the Vice study of the 1913-14 period, progressive sociologists roundly condemned permitting vice to be visible or seen in the communities. And then you had progressive sociologists in the 1930s beginning to talk about homosexuality not as a crime, but as a condition of people, and so they were exploring new theories, and the same with the studies right at the end of the war and following, is that, you know, they were showing that gay men and lesbians had actually served in the military services, even though the military had tried to screen them out. So the whole question about whether gay men and women could be patriotic or not is whole part of that McCarthy period of the Lavender Scare. And in Wisconsin, there was resistance to that, as well as sort of admittedly hiding as well.
Right. And I did want to touch upon that with Senator Joe McCarthy being of one of Wisconsin's
yep.
you know, big historical figures. You found he was prosecuting gays more than communists, yet that wasn't getting as much attention in the press. You know, we think of McCarthyism, we think of communism being
right,
rooted out
right.
by any means possible. Right. So what was this other side to it?
Well, McCarthy, in his own words, was quite against commies and queers. And one of the Republican bosses in the state urged the Republicans nationally to pick up the McCarthy charges because he was having an effect against homosexuals in government. So the whole apparatus, which was focused about trying to rid homosexuals out of government service, comes in with actually the Eisenhower administration. Previously, homosexuals might have been judged as a security risk on an individual basis, but with the McCarthy period and the Eisenhower executive order, it was a whole class of people just by their status that was considered a security risk. So you know, Wisconsin went through that as well. There were folks at Truax who were sort of bopped out of the military services. But many more nevertheless served and resisted that.
Another thing to touch upon that I feel is important is also along Wisconsin institutions, UW-Wisconsin's treatment of gay students. You know, we here
right.
at Milwaukee's NPR, we're under UW-Milwaukee, which is, of course, part
right.
of the bigger UW system.
Right.
So could you touch upon how the gay students were treated at UW-Wisconsin-Madison in particular when it comes to regards of therapeutic discipline and the 1962 purge? I feel like when people think of our college institutions, this is not touched upon a whole lot.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
The Madison campus initiated a what they called, as you said, therapeutic discipline, where if someone was found out to be homosexual, and it was all men, that they were sent to psychiatrists because they were presumed to be sick and that maybe they could be adjusted or cured. Some of them played along with that because they wanted to get readmitted back into the university. Others simply said, no, I'm not sick. I don't want to go to the psychiatrist. So, but in those cases, they often lost financial support or were denied access to the School of Medicine or the College of Education because it wasn't thought those were appropriate roles for homosexuals to fill. There had been some earlier cases arising in Milwaukee at the Extension operation, which caused a Regents investigation, which listed a 1,000-page report, and there were concerns then raised over counseling of a potential lesbian student in the Milwaukee system, as well as there was a controversy that arose with the firing of the dean of the Extension system over in Milwaukee, who then charged that President Frank at the university and his backers in the Progressive Party were supporting immorality, including homosexual immorality, in that period. And the progressives and socialists in the state joined in the fight against that and beating back that attack.
Is that unique to Wisconsin history compared to other states who had similar things going on with Wisconsin's Progressive Party influence?
Right. This mini lavender scare in the 30s did not occur in many places. There was also, it was both a lavender and red scare in the 30s, and there were very few of those around the country. And to align the forces of the Progressive Party and the Socialist out of Milwaukee against that showed that they had moved from where they were in the pre-World War period, where they were all against suppressing vice. And in this case, they were sort of fighting against these sort of lavender scare charges that had been raised, in this case by conservative Democrats.
How did you find that people within the university were resilient in finding ways to fight back against what was happening?
Well, the remarkable thing is that you have the predominant narrative from homophobia that homosexuals are criminals or they're sick. And the way to counteract that was to try and get their own voices heard. It's similar to the post-Stonewall coming out experience of where telling your own stories is a way to contradict the assumptions, wrongheaded assumptions about gays and lesbians. And so by gay people participating in these studies by UW academics in the 30s and the 40s and into the 50s, they were trying to change the narrative by actually describing their own lives as not something quite so odd. And the other interesting thing was that in many of the comments, they would talk about not sex, but about love. And so that was also trying to change the definition, because the also other assumption and narrative was that, you know, homosexuals were all sex fiends, and of course heterosexuals were not sex fiends.
What do you think is one of the most valuable lessons readers can take away from learning about Wisconsin's early gay history?
One of it is the agency of gays and lesbians themselves in establishing their lives and in establishing places where they could live and beginning to tell their stories. And others, and this is the first volume of two volumes, and the second volume tells the remarkable story of how that early impulse for liberation in Wisconsin is fully realized when we become the first state to pass a gay rights law.
Madison writer Dick Wagner is the author of We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can find out more information at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then our film critic previews 1917. Lake Effect continues right after this. Lake Effect continues. I'm Bonnie North. Experiencing wars through the medium of film is often one of the few ways that audiences can connect with a tragedy of conflict. World War II and Vietnam have had their share of films, but World War I has yet to get quite the same treatment. 1917, however, could change that. Written and directed by Sam Mendes, the film follows two young British soldiers who have to deliver a message past no man's land in order to keep fellow soldiers from walking into a trap. 1917 is shot by cinematographer Roger Deakins, and it's made to look like it's made in one continuous take, and it takes the audience literally into the trenches as well. Film contributor Dave Lurson recently joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss 1917, and he starts with a portion of his review.
War is never pleasant, but war was seldom bloodier than the conflict that dragged on from 1914 through 1918. World War I was a stubborn struggle of national egotism with morally blind leaders playing chess with millions of lives. Both the Allies and the Germans were willing to lose tens of thousands of men to gain 10 yards of mud.
1917 is the latest World War I epic, directed by Sam Mendes, who previously is known for the James Bond film Skyfall. Now, you, as someone who studies war portrayed in film, I'm very curious to know your first impressions.
Well, I think that 1917 contains some of the most graphically realistic depictions of the no man's land, as it was called, separating the lines of trenches on the Western Front. This was kind of a static war that, you know, ground was not given easily on the Western Front during World War I. And, you know, the dead horses, the dead men impaled on barbed wire, the flies scattering around the dead, the big rats that wanted to live in the trenches alongside the people, finding food, I suppose. The horror of men being buried alive in shell craters, a particularly memorable scene where the protagonists of this movie stumble into a deep crater and that you see the faces of the dead kind of halfway through. These are all very realistic situations. I have to say one thing about the basic story here. You have two British soldiers on a mission to cross no man's land to give an order to a frontline regiment about to attack the Germans. Aerial reconnaissance, kind of a new thing at that time, detected that the Germans were really laying a trap. And so people nowadays might ask, well, why did you have to send two people with a handwritten message basically across this territory to instruct the frontline soldiers not to attack? I actually think that there might have been a better way to do it than depicted in the movie, but there really were messengers delivering orders by hand at the front lines. There was radio in those days, but there seemed to be very few radio sets actually operating. There were field telephones, two phones connected by cable strung across the ground. And naturally, the cables were very vulnerable to weather, to shell fire, to virtually anything. And that was unreliable. So people really did have to clamber around through trenches to deliver messages. Whether messages were delivered across the no man's land, I don't know. I never come across that. But the director and writer, Sam Mendes, says that he was inspired by stories told by his grandfather who served at the front. I have a feeling this particular story was made up, but a lot of the details are based on things that his grandfather recalled.
Right. It really does give you a sobering picture. And in a film world, at least, where I think perhaps World War II tends to be favored over telling World War I stories, what do you think of that dynamic?
World War I is much more remembered in Canada and in Europe than it is in the United States, because of the enormous losses to the populations of European countries and Canada, too. For the U.S., it was kind of, you know, the last-minute type of thing. It would appear that the arrival of the Americans tilted the balance finally. The German lines broke, the war ended, and everybody came home, and, you know, that was it for a while until World War II. But for other countries, World War I left a much deeper scar on the national imagination.
You mentioned that, you know, we would question why would it take so long to send something as unsafe as having a soldier carry a note to a mission. But that is something I did think about after seeing this movie immediately after. It's like, how much time, not necessarily wasted, but how much time can you account for the way that these messages had to be delivered? How many operations still went forward? How many people went, you know, into the trenches or other missions because they didn't get word in time?
Well, think about all wars probably before World War II. I mean, there wasn't much communication except really by shouting out your orders or delivering a message of some kind verbally or in writing. How did the Civil War, how did the wars of Napoleon, how did the troop movements occur? How did orders get communicated? I mean, World War I was, I think, the last major war in which you could see something like messengers scampering toward the front line saying, stop. After that point, I mean, radio made things a little bit more easy to coordinate.
We should talk about the actors who, of course, are the center of this film. There's Dean Charles Chapman, who plays Lance Corporal Blake, and George McKay, who plays Lance Corporal Schofield. Now, this is, in a way, also an accurate portrayal of war, that here's two random soldiers resting on a field, and they're told, hey, get up, you have a new mission.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this nature of it allows for much emotional investment in the story, or is this film more about the spectacle and the technical marvel that we'll touch upon later?
Well, you know, one thing I never liked about Saving Private Ryan, one of everybody else's favorite war films, is all the sitting around talking about, you know, the wife and children and life at home. I don't really think that in combat situations there was a whole lot of that in reality. And in this movie, you know, we learn just, I guess, barely enough about the two main characters to have a sense for who they would have been. Their backstories arise little by little through the course of the movie. They are really too busy to survive than to have, like, long conversations about things. And, you know, if they've already known each other, and that's before the film began. So I really didn't have a problem with that aspect of it. But yeah, I think that Sam Mendes was very concerned with the technical bravura aspect of making it look as though it was one continuing long take. Actually, there were several takes kind of disguised cleverly. But the long take method did, I think, enhance the idea that you and the audience were there, trailing them ahead of them by a few feet, following them along as they went on their mission. I found it to be effective.
And the cinematographer is Roger Deakins, who is one of the greatest cinematographers in the field. And what I found amazing is that there's all the cameras, at least especially in the trenches and in the battlefields, they're handheld. There's no tracks, you know, there's mm-hmm. no camera dollies, especially the way you're going through some of these trenches. And when I saw this screening, it was on an IMAX screen, and I think I was perhaps a little too close, a little too immersed. So maybe disclosure for some audience members, if you do get a little motion sickness, sit up higher or don't see it on an IMAX screen. But it was very effective. Like, I had to look away at points because it's like, while you are in there, and there's definitely, it's a focused, briskly paced story. And then you do feel trapped for some of the movie, especially depending on the setting that you're in.
Yes, you do. But there is one problem that I had starting around the halfway point. The film action began to seem more like a video game to me, where at every corner, danger will explode, something will happen. I think that Mendes overdid that a little bit. There probably really would have been many long moments of tedium in crawling, you know, on your belly or keeping low to the ground, crossing no man's land, trying to avoid sniper fire, and the film does, you know, show that. On the other hand, you know, riding down river rapids across a waterfall, down, I mean, it's a little bit Indiana Jones, and I don't think that it was very realistic in that respect.
Yeah, and with the use of time, although it's about just under 2 hours, it doesn't feel long, and the breaks, I feel, are as much for the audience as they are for the character. Like you said, you're just waiting for the next terrible thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. There could have been about two less terrible things in the movie.
Yeah. With the use of sound, how effective do you think that was?
Very,
there were some scenes where I thought it did a great job.
Very good point. The sound was used very acutely in the movie. The sloshing sound of boots on muddy surfaces, and a lot of no man's land was very muddy. There was a lot of rainfall during this period of time on the Western Front. Some say that all of the artillery and gun smoke somehow affected the weather systems overhead. There was a lot of rain, a lot of mud. The heavy clunking sound of the gear that soldiers had at that time. These weren't lightweight weapons. The kits and shoulder packs that they carried, everything was made from organic materials, wood and leather and fabric. And your kits was stuffed with tinned, canned supplies. You were lugging a heavy load with you, crossing the no man's land, and the sound of it sometimes came through quite well.
the movie magic of this film, the scale of the sets. You have a whole abandoned town. You have trenches built. You have battlefields. I was quite impressed with the amount of production work that went into this one.
Well, it looks like a very expensive production. I think that Mendez made limited use of CGI, you know, to achieve what he did. I think there was some in there. But basically, he did it, you could say, the old-fashioned way, which enhanced the realism of it.
What do you think of his direction overall and writing? He both directed and wrote.
You could say it's kind of a laconic screenplay. And again, I think effectively so, because too much chit-chat would not have enhanced the reality of the situation that the men were in. The direction of it, I mean, he may very well have aimed to impress audiences. He impressed me with the cinematography and the assembly of the shots to suggest the idea that there was a camera following everyone around through the course of a two-hour adventure across no man's land. So that was all done quite well. I think it's also good to note that two of the biggest stars in the film have very small roles, Colin Firth and Benedict Cumberbatch, which I think testifies to the respect that Sam Mendes enjoys in the British film industry, that they would, play a 1 minute basically part as British officers at different ends of the movie.
Well, and it kind of highlights that these were just young boys and young men thrown into the midst of everything.
Well, they were the ones who suffered the most.
Mm-hmm. Now, this film has been getting a lot of traction at award shows. It won the Best Picture at the annual Hollywood Critics Association Awards, won Best Picture Golden Globes, tied for Best Director at the Critics' Choice Awards, and won Best Cinematography there as well. Do you see this carrying the same traction to our ever-esteemed Oscar season coming up very soon?
Well, it's definitely going to be a contender. What works against it? Well, maybe it's not, it's a very British film. It's probably going to win the BAFTA, the British Academy of Film Awards. And there are British members of the Academy, voting members, of the Academy here in Hollywood. So there could be some carryover from that. I think it's going to be an interesting season. I'm right now about to prepare myself to look over the contenders. I'm anxiously awaiting the nominations, and we'll see. But I mean, I would be willing to wager that 1917 will be nominated in many categories and will be a strong contender in all of them.
Dave Lurson is our film contributor and the arts and entertainment editor for The Shepherd Express. He spoke with Lake Effect's Arjun Okowski about the film 1917, which is out now. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Arjun Okowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. We also get support from the WUWM News team, including Emily Files this week. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy our studio engineer, and Michelle Matternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again Saturday and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.